Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 256 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley. And today's episode is on how does categorising relationships impact morality? And it is Saturday the 9th of March 2024 as I record this. So the reason why I wanted to do today's episode is because on Monday, one of my friends made this really quite off-the-cuff comment about morality and how it really interests them. So I didn't think too much of it. And then later that night when I got home, I was thinking, yeah, I guess morality is quite interesting. I guess I've never really covered morality that much. So I went on my laptop, went through all my different books by using the Microsoft Word Find function. That is a lifesaver, and I love that feature now more than ever. And I looked at however many times I had mentioned morality. I've mentioned it a few places, and then I realised there's only one chapter in developmental psychology that properly focuses on morality. So I thought, oh, considering how important morality is, we should probably focus on it a little bit more. And today's research and today's psychology podcast episode is actually quite brilliant. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it, and it really shows us how varied morality can be and the sort of behaviours we're willing to perform for some people, but definitely not others. So this is a great episode. I really enjoyed it. And if you're interested in social psychology, then you're definitely going to love today's episode too. So we're moving on to the psychology news section. We're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest. And the first one is, are you still feeling crummy after COVID? Current research estimates that 1 in 10 COVID cases results in long COVID, a constellation of often debilitating symptoms that develop 4 to 12 weeks following an initial infection. According to the figures released by the Office of National Statistics, the condition now affects the daily lives and functioning of millions of people in the UK, and with SARS-CoV-2, the virus which causes COVID, still widely circulating, the risk of developing long COVID is ongoing and increasing with each infection. As a widely stigmatised condition, often assumed by clinicians and the general public to be psychological, it's important for us as psychologists to understand and share new developments, digest what they mean for those with a long COVID, and integrate these understandings into our field. And then at the BPS Research Digest, has a long list of the various long COVID findings made recently. But the reason why I'm not actually going to focus on that is because there are some larger points there. And this is actually quite timely because today I finished a new psychology book about the myths and misconceptions. And one of the myths and things that I actually tackle is actually about stigma. And I completely agree, long COVID is quite stigmatised because even though it impacts millions of people in the UK government has refused to talk about it, at least in any meaningful fashion, because I've seen some of the debates in our houses of parliament, and I think it's quite head-shaking because there's no acknowledgement that long COVID actually exists, well, to some extent, and then there's also no real acknowledgement about what support there should be for these people, because it's no one's fault of getting long COVID, So it's just an interesting one, and like there needs to be more support. We need to decrease the like stigma around it, because by getting rid of the stigma, then that helps the people get support, and if people get support, then they can live a better life. They can work more, which means they can pay more tax. So the idea that any government isn't taking long COVID seriously, I think it's quite a silly one, especially in this day and age where economies aren't exactly booming. So it's an interesting one. And as psychologists, and to be honest, as any psychology students, professionals, etc., it is all of our jobs to try and share research and share findings that are going to improve people's lives. Because it's one of the reasons why I do this podcast. Because this podcast and all of you wonderful listeners gives me a platform to talk about like various things. And some of these will be really like useful to different people. So hopefully I can improve like some lives, and hopefully I can make a bit of a difference. So it's an interesting one. Definitely food for thought. So the next one is, runners high. Could cannabis before exercising encourage fitness? Many readers will be aware that cannabis is generally associated with sedation and relaxation. In recent years, however, amateur and even professional athletes have been advocating for its use whilst exercising, by the authors of a brand new paper in Sports Medicine. Given this and increasing acceptance of this usage around the globe, there's an urgent need to properly investigate the impact of cannabis on exercise, according to Laurel P. Gibson at the University of Colorado Boulder and colleagues. In their paper, the team describes the first study to explore the effects of a commercially available cannabis products, i.e. with concentrations of active ingredients that are generally available to consumers, on how people feel about exercise in a lab environment. The nature of the research meant the study had various limitations, but the results suggest that cannabis may indeed make workouts more enjoyable in some ways, though what was also a drawback, the drug made exercise feel more effortful. Okay, so I think, wow, I mean, like, where do we start up with this? So, for starters, one of the obvious methodology flaws with, like, this one was that no one ever exercises in a lab in the real world. So, ecological fluidity is basically automatically decreased because you can't necessarily generalize the results to the real world simply because you didn't use a real world environment. So that's one downside. Also, cannabis, I mean, I've done podcast episodes on it before, and I've actually got some research to actually share on the podcast in the future about cannabis. So I think cannabis, I would always stay away from it, but I know that there are some benefits. I know for some people it can be really helpful, and I know there are some medical benefits too. So I don't know, I think it's pros and cons, but personally I will always stay away from my cannabis unless I had absolutely no other choice for medical reasons. But I also think that the drawback itself is quite interesting. The drug made exercise feel more effortful. So if exercise is harder, people tend to avoid stuff which is harder than like not doing it. So if the whole idea is to motivate people to exercise, then cannabis probably isn't the way to do it. And I would have to look at more of the research specifically, but it'd be interesting to see, did these researchers divide the people up into a group? So for example, was there people who don't normally enjoy exercise? And was this group compared to people that normally like exercising? Because I think if there were those two groups, then that's the only real way of actually knowing that cannabis is helpful to motivate people. So I think it's a fascinating idea. I personally tend to stay away from cannabis research, but I think that it could have a lot of potential benefits, especially if cannabis is found to improve people's motivation to exercise. So definitely something to think about for the future. And the final one is using Twitter a net negative for well-being? I will say yes, but let's see what the research says. Those who spend a lot of time online may have come across the phrase touch grass, a saying that essentially extorts someone to step away from the keyboard and go outside. Though clearly somewhat tongue-in-cheek, what underlies this phrase is a sense that being online too much is detrimental to someone's sense of reason and perspective, and that logging off and reconnecting with the real world is likely to make them a lot happier. But how does social media really impact our well-being? Looking specifically at Twitter, a team from the University of Toronto explores this question in the new paper, asking whether the platform is overall beneficial or detrimental to well-being. They find, perhaps unsurprisingly to those of us who still use the site, that Twitter use is not only related to decreased well-being, but increases in political polarisation and outrage too. Yeah, I mean, I do tend to stay away from Twitter. I post on Twitter once a week, just so I can share the podcast. And there are some political stuff that I like to follow there, but I don't use it. And I literally go on Twitter to share the podcast, to look at political stuff once a week, and to be honest, that's it. And I mean, that's literally it. I don't like Twitter. I will never call it X because, out of respect to Elon Musk's daughter, and it's just I just think that, just Twitter, just stay away from it. Just stay away from Twitter. It's not a good place. And to be honest, that's the same for a lot of social media these days. I just don't really use social media because it's just such a toxic place. So I think it's a shame because I think Twitter used to be quite good back in the day. But of course, that was a long, long time ago now. But I think the larger point about this article is very, very true. And even though touch grass is very tongue-in-cheek, we've got to go outside, we've got to mix up people, we've got to socially interact with newer people and get new egg-like experiences. That's one of the reasons why I love my outreach job at my university. It gets me to meet students, it gets me to meet new people, and you get to hear some interesting ideas. That's all I'm going to say. Because there was a debate about the death penalty. Quite a concerning debate, to be honest, towards the end. But it was interesting. It was good to get my own beliefs challenged. And I don't know, it's just, I really like that interaction and just reconnecting with the real world. So that's definitely in Portland. And maybe this week, think about how much time you spend online, or how much time do you spend in your own echo chamber. So just something to think about. So I hope you enjoyed the psychology news section. So let's move on to the person update. So we're moving on to the personal update. So this week has been really busy and really good because I'm definitely starting quite a few new projects. Not only some particular psychology books there, but I'm studying writing and also statistics, in which, to be honest, going off on a slight tangent here, statistics we've also given up at the moment, but I'm definitely going to focus, and to be honest, I think this particular topic, I think I will have to do a podcast episode on, because One of the great things about podcasting is that I always try and make the podcast episodes quite accessible, very easy to understand. And because this topic is quite hard, I think I need to try and distill it and try and teach it to you just so I can truly understand it myself, because I have no idea how to explain it. Like, I know how to use it and I know how to do it. And for anyone who's like wondering, it's a confirmatory factor analysis. And this week was on the pathway models. Okay, that probably went over quite a few people's heads. It went over my head for the first hour. And to be honest, like, even now, I'm not entirely sure though. So I am very much looking forward to only having 3 more statistics lectures in my life. Like, and that's actually quite exciting, because come the 3rd of April 2024, I no longer have to do statistics for the rest of my life. Like, I'll definitely still keep a tab on it, and I'll definitely try and like refresh my knowledge over the years. But yes, I never have to sit in a lecture theatre again and learn statistics. I'm quite excited about that, to be honest. But one of the projects I do want to tell you about is, well, to be honest, I can't say that much, because their Parkinson Research and Therapy Centre has actually moved back to, well, towards the university campus. It's actually quite interesting, because now that a friend of mine is actually head of like research, he's actually got me involved in a particular project, which is the initial stages of developing a brief psychological intervention for Parkinson's, which I'm quite excited about, because I know from reading quite a few job descriptions that any sort of work with any sort of like clinic work is always in like important, and delivering psychological interventions, that's another skill that they always like quite like. So I think that even though this is like the beginning of the project, it would be really, really good to actually start getting in like involved in that. And something else that I'm really going to try and like push for in the Parkinson Centre is that the university wants to get quite heavily involved with like students and become like a critical part of the Parkinson Centre. And I said to my friends, well, you're going to need someone to like run that bit, and you're going to need someone to supervise the like students, because my friend knows my people management skills. They are amazing, if I do say so myself, because I mean, like, I can manage people quite easily, and using a really friendly like management style. So I think come September, I do want to start getting involved in the research centre more though, like from the like supervision bit, because I've been looking at some job descriptions. And I know clinical supervision is very, very different. I do understand that. But I know jobs after you become fully qualified as a clinical psychologist, they do want you to have supervision experience. So if I can get some good experience in the last year of my master's, supervising like different undergrad students, master's students and volunteers, then I think that's going to be very useful. And to be honest, it's just going to be fun. Like, I'm really excited about the Parkinson Centre, because it turns out I know absolutely nothing about Parkinson's. I don't have a clue. My friend was telling me all this stuff, and I was like, yep, I had no idea there were stages of Parkinson's. I had no idea there was different types. I had no idea about that. I had no idea about this. Because my interest lays more in depression, anxiety, to be honest, just the more common stuff. So more of the common mental health conditions. Parkinson's, never even looked at before. But I'm going to learn a lot, which is going to be a lot of fun. And as always, I always love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can always email me, connorwiley@connorwiley.net. You can always leave a comment out of the show notes at connorwiley.net/podcast. And you can always leave a comment out of the show notes at connorwiley.net/podcast. Or tweet me on Twitter @scifiwiley. And today's episode has been sponsored by Psychology of Relationships, the social psychology of friendships, romantic relationships, and more. So the reason why this is a great sponsor for today's episode is because we're focusing on friendships and the different types of relationships, whether these would be working relationships, friendships, or to be honest, even family relationships. So with this great, really easy to understand book focuses on the biological, cognitive, and the social factors are behind about what forms relationships, be them friendships or romantic relationships. And then it explores the topic of relationships in a lot of really great depth. For example, how does communication work? How do relationships change and end? But then it also talks about theories of sexuality. So it looks at cultural reasons, psychological reasons, but also then it also talks about the theories behind homosexuality and about how like that develops. And to be honest, I think that chapter's quite funny because you can see the research has no idea, has absolutely no idea whatsoever. But it's still quite interesting to read about where people have thoughts that homosexuality comes from, and about some of the more modern ideas. To be honest, I think theories about any sexuality are quite pointless, but it's always good to learn, I guess. And then, like, in the last part of the book, I've actually been revisiting quite a lot lately, because it talks about bystanderism, altruism, pro-social behaviour, and how do we improve pro-social behaviour. So that's quite an important one, and that's something that I really do like. I recommend, because it is interesting, and that definitely fits in with like today's episode about morality, because morality is also about pro-social behavior and anti-social behavior. So it's quite interesting to see why do people help and why people don't help. So I really do recommend it. So that is Psychology of Relationships, the Social Psychology of Friendships, Romantic Relationships, and more. Available at all major ebook retailers, and you can order the paperback and hardback version from Amazon, your local bookstore, or local library if you requested. Also, you can also order the audiobook version, narrated by artificial intelligence, available from selected audiobook retailers like Amazon, Google Play, Scribe, Barnes & Noble, and selected library systems like Overdrive and Baker & Taylor. Also, whilst buying books helps to support the creation and the editing of the podcast, my time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And as always, a massive thank you to my patrons, as your support shows that you like the show and that you want this to continue. So if you want to become a patron and get tons of great rewards, now you can at patreon.com/ The Psychology World Podcast. So that's enough of the personal update. Let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So moving on to the content part of today's episode, so we're going to be talking about how does categorizing our relationships impact moral judgments? So this is a really fun episode and I really enjoyed it. So let's dive into it. How could relationships impact morality? Now, I fully admit, when I came across this research, I wasn't entirely convinced that different types of relationships might impact different moral behaviors. Then I started thinking about it, and I realised just how common this is. For example, two easy examples are when I go out with a university friend of mine for dinner, and it's the two of us, we both pay for our own dinners. To be honest, that's whatever happens whenever I go out with any of my friends. Yet I am willing to pay for the dinner of my closest friend, because I'm closer to them and they're great. Whereas if I'm having lunch with my friend that is also my supervisor, or will be in the future, at my university's Parkinson Centre, I have absolutely no ethical problems with letting him pay for my lunch, because he has the job and I'm helping him out, so it's only sort of fair. And to be honest, I never abuse that kind of offer, I promise. In that example, you can see three different examples of relationships, and how I approach the very common idea of paying for a meal differently. Are these really moral behaviours, though? If you had asked me before this podcast episode, I would have said these basic examples have nothing to do with morality, but some researchers disagree, especially because morality is all about what behaviours are right and wrong in a given situation. So I'm sure some of you would say I shouldn't want my supervisor to always pay. Granted, we actually don't go out for lunch that often, and I never abused the offer, but some of you would agree that I'm right. Then, when we start thinking about additional factors, this gets more complex. For example, what if one of my friends was poor and struggles with the money? Should I automatically pay for their dinner to help them out? Or, what if I was struggling with the money for the time? Is it morally right for me to ask my friend to help me pay for dinner so I could eat that night? Again, it's a moral question, but it's very interesting to think about. Some of you would say yes, some of you would say that it was an immoral favour to ask. That's why this is a great topic to look at. What are the four types of relationships and how do these impact morality? Looking at the work of anthropologist Alan Frisk, 1991, he categorises human relationships into four types. Firstly, you have communal sharing relationships, where our in-groups are basically the same as us in relevant ways. Some examples of this would include teams at work, military units, as well as our family. Secondly, you have equality matching. These are relationships where we view others as our equals, like people who we take turns with at home or work, or people we care to maintain our impartiality with. I know this one is a little complicated, but don't worry. I'll explain these categories in more details in a moment. Thirdly, you have authority ranking, where we rank ourselves and others into a hierarchy or to a position, for example, a caste, work titles, or seniority. Finally, you have market pricing, where we view others as trader partners. These are people we view through a contractual lens. For example, people who we interact with because they help us so that we help them, and vice versa. As a result of these categories, Ray and Frisk, 2011, argue humans are motivated to behave differently towards each of these categories, and one of these examples is how we're happy to share resources with family members, but we get annoyed when a friend keeps asking us for stuff without a thank you, them spending time to cultivate our friendship, and without reciprocating the favour. Now, let's explore these categories in more depth. Mutual sharing and morality. When it comes to communal sharing relationships, these are focused on an attitude of a unity towards the in-group. Since, as we all know, maintaining any inner group is not easy at times, and there will be problems. Therefore, there is high motivation to maintain the in-group, because the people in the group want to benefit the group over and beyond the people outside the in-group. Due to, in-group members believe that they have a common fate, which they want to be positive. I can't stress that enough. We all want a positive fate in the end. Therefore, maintaining communal relationships relies on tribalism and, in a sense, keeping the tribe pure, resulting in in-group members being morally motivated to eliminate these threats, even if they come at a very high moral price. Interestingly, an international example of this communal sharing that Wright and Frisk, 2011, mentioned is the Hutu Ten Commandments that mention how the unity as well as the fate of the Hutu people are perceived to be threatened by the Tutsi, resulting in this fueling propaganda that led to the Rwandan genocide. A more personal example would be family attitudes towards kicking out queer members of a family. I know from personal experience and the stories with friends how a family unit wants to remain united and pure, so there is minimal conflict that leads to family breakdown. So sometimes the easiest option is just to kick out the queer member of the family, making them homeless and completely cut off for the rest of the family. Now notice how I never said the easy option is the moral option. It's just disgusting, and some families really are immoral. Equality matching and morality. Our next type of relationship is focused on striking equal balances, which leads to a lot of positive ideas about morality. For example, human rights are thankfully all about treating others as equals. Governments should always treat people with dignity and respect, as well as we should treat others how we want to be treated. In addition, striking an equal balance helps humans to cooperate in situations where we can't distribute resources equally or when it comes to taking turns. Originally, we evolved these rules to limit free riders because no one likes them at all. So this led to humanity developing some very elegant cooperation norms, like tit for tat, so that we can all generally trust each other in our economic and social interactions. These norms generally work because the people are motivated to maintain these rules and equality, because acting immorally or against these rules results in punishment. And I always quite like anthropology research from time to time, because you get to hear about random tribes. Hence the, and I do apologise, I'm going to butcher this name, the Hamra code reflects the extreme lengths people can go to protect this balance, as does the ancient Babylonian ideal of an eye for an eye. And even today, there are many countries that continue to institutionalize balance keeping by the process of capital punishment, a life for a life. Now, we could have an entire moral debate about the concept of a life for a life, but I've already had that debate with some 15-year-old children this week, so I'm very good, thank you. And we generally understand how capital punishment and balance keeping informs morality. Authority ranking and moral judgments. Whereas in these social relationships, people are motivated to maintain a hierarchy regardless of its type. This involves people respecting and deferring to an authority figure, and this authority figure should provide protection and take responsibility to some extent for the subordinate's actions. The easiest example of this is the military, as well as military command structures and units. Normally, this hierarchy and social relationship is beneficial for everyone involved, since if we take a parental example, then a parent can demand respect from their young and vulnerable children. In exchange, the parent not only protects their children from harm, but the parent comes to the child's defence too. As you can see, it's a useful for encouraging moral behaviour. Unfortunately, this social relationship can cause immoral behaviour as well. For example, people in leadership positions are often thought to be more entitled to the group's resources than other people, like CEOs having bigger offices, extra benefits and larger paychecks. And I won't even get into the argument about whether the idea of them having bigger paychecks is moral or not, because I think it depends. Because I mean, like, you hear what some of the bankers make, and it's like, how is that fair when poverty is increasing? Anyway, leaders can become corrupt and authoritarian too. Then, if we remember Milgram studies, we realise that subordinates are willing to follow extreme orders from authority figures, even if it harms other people. That is definitely not moral behaviour. Market pricing impacting social judgments. Our final type of a social relationship comes from market pricing, and these relationships are maintained by an in-between system of value to compare different goods. Now, believe me, I get this was a weird explanation, but what it means is that this is a relationship that is essentially an economic market, where people in these relationships are motivated to maintain proportionality. In other words, make sure that each other is applied an equal value. These economic principles can extend to the social world too, because when good and evil behaviours are weighed against each other, this is what people use to determine the best course of action. If we look at the criminal justice system, juries have to decide on how much time a criminal should spend in a prison in relation to the seriousness of the crime. We expect a system of meritocracy at work, where the promotion or pay rise goes to the most deserving employee, and commanders are meant to determine how many lives lost are worth an action for the greater good. How do these categories mix? And conclusion. It's hard to think of any social relationships that are only one of these four types of categories, because there is an overlap. For instance, if we think about dividing up a bill after a nicer dinner, this is hard because going out with a friend could be equality matching, because we all want equal friendships, and it could be communal sharing, to be honest. Or if we're out for dinner with a supervisor slash friend, it could be authority ranking, equality matching, and market pricing. On the whole, the entire point of today's episode is to show you that moral outrage as well as feelings get hurt because of these different types of relationships, especially when they don't match your expectations. For example, I know a lot of great trans people, and I admit this is a little bit of an odd example, but there is a reason for this. And a part of medical transitioning are different surgeries if they want them. Therefore, if a friend of mine had a surgery with a 6-week recovery time, and I helped them out for the majority of that time, then I would feel good because I helped out a friend and I did the right moral thing in that situation. Then I would be working under the assumption this was a communal sharing relationship, because they're part of my inner group and the common fate of the friendship group is tied together. Then, let's say later I received an email and a bank transfer from my friend via PayMe for my time, and the email consisted of a list of the amounts that they were paying me for each thing I did for them. So this would be deeply hurtful, because this friend would be categorising our friendship as a market pricing relationship instead of what I believed it to be. Of course, this example has and this example will never happen, but similar hurt feelings have happened before to me. And this example is a good one, showing how we categorise friendships impacts our moral judgments, because I'll tell you now, I would not go above and beyond for a market pricing relationship in comparison to a communal sharing relationship. And this is a great little thinking exercise, because we all have examples of these four relationships in our lives. So ask yourself a simple question. How far would your moral behaviour go for the people in each type of friendships? Because there's a big difference between paying for a cheap dinner and being close enough to someone to want to spend 6 weeks with them after an operation. What do you think? So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode and you got something out of it. I know that I did, because I am starting to look more at morality for a few psychology projects, because it is quite interesting when you get into it. I know social psychology isn't something I normally focus on, and to be honest, I probably will take a long break after this, but it is interesting because there are lots of different applied ways. Like, I've actually got some clinical psychology stuff, which I'm quite excited about. So if you know someone who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always grateful when you want for people help spread the word about the podcast. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Psychology of Relationships, the Social Psychology of Friendships, Romantic Relationships, and more. Available at all the usual places. And if you want to become a patron of the show and get tons of great rewards, now you can. At patreon.com/psychologyworldpodcast. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Welcome to the Psychology World Podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics, and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show.